This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. Today we have a programme that explores aspects of political correctness, changes of attitudes towards sex, religion, and politics, and all in the name of antiques and art. There are prices for pieces that will surprise, for objects that will intrigue. We take an excursion into the Irish pronunciation, an Irish provincial town which occasionally produced silver. I think you'll be surprised. Which one is it? And there's more about silver too. We read about the struggles of a truly heroic and heavily disabled artist from a bygone era before a national health system, or the notion of inclusiveness as promoted by the services of this excellent radio station, 2RPH. Do museums have secret stories? Are there things they'd not like to display? Listen in and listen on. So let's start by turning on the gas and putting the foot to the floor. In the Antiques Trade Gazette of the 11th of January, on page 6. Rusting BP enamel sign is the winner in Welsh sale. Rescued from a skip, a rusting British enamel advertising sign sold for £10,400, plus 24% buyer's premium, at an auction in Carmarthen, writes Roland Arkell. That's around 24,000 Australian dollars all up. Although in poor condition, it has significant losses to the lower half, the 3 foot 6 inch by 2 foot 4 inch, that's 1.05 meters by 70 centimeters, item, offered for sale by Peter Francis on December 18th, with an estimate of £1,000 to £2,000, is considered something of a holy grail object for collectors of early motoring signs. Made in the 1920s, the evocative image depicts a racing car passing the finishing line at speed, with the legend beneath reading, "The Winner, BP, the British Petrol." The Winner advertising sign was produced for British Petroleum in 3 sizes, of which this is the largest. Only a handful of others have been seen at auction, including a superbly preserved example which sold for £28,000, plus 15% buyer's premium, at the Canterbury Auction Galleries in 2005, still considered an auction record for a British enamel advertising sign. Another example, in decent condition, sold for £8,000 at Stride & Son of Chichester in 2016. And there's a picture to go with that article, and I must say the sign does look pretty tatty, but it certainly has a lot of energy and vitality about it. We now have 3 items of silver, which all tell different stories. Firstly, a claret jug. What shapes and form can they take? Well, here's a most unusual one. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 18th of January on page 15. Performing elephant. Victorian silver novelties do not come much better than this claret jug, formed as a 9-inch, that's 23-centimetre, tall, kneeling elephant by James Barclay Hennell, London, 1881. The hinged head, currently lacking tusks, forms the cover. The rare 32-ounce vessel, a must for any collector seeking to amass a menagerie of Victorian animal claret jugs, was offered at Druitt's, which is 25% buyer's premium, in Newbury on the 27th of November, with a tempting estimate of £1,200 to £1,800. Instead, it took £21,000. And all up with buyer's premium, that's over 45,000 Australian dollars, which makes it a very, very special glass of claret that you'll be pouring out of it, I think. And for our next item, it helps to know one or two things. Firstly, a basting spoon is a very large serving spoon, much bigger than a tablespoon, and used for serving. And our second piece of information we need is to know what a yawl is. It's a boat. Now, armed with that information, we have the title of a piece from the Antiques Trade Gazette on the 18th of January, which is titled Y-O-U-G-H-A-L Basting Spoon. And how are you going to pronounce that? No, it's not the Irish provincial town of Youghal. It's the Irish provincial town of Youghal. So it reads, Youghal Basting Spoon. Alongside pieces made in Kinsale, Galway and Waterford, silver from the small county Cork town of Youghal is among the scarcest of all Irish silver. Only a handful of pieces survive that carry the punning town mark of a Youghal. This 4-ounce, 13-inch, that's 33-centimetre, long Hanoverian rat-tail basting spoon is struck E.G. for Edward Gillett and twice with the town mark. Gillett, a freeman of the town by 1711, was an important figure in Youghal's mercantile activity, and he was the mayor in 1721, around the time this spoon was made. His son John also worked as a goldsmith in the town later in the century. This spoon was the earliest piece of Irish silver sold at Woolley and Wallace, 25% buyer's premium, since a Charles II Trefid spoon took £7,500 in the Salisbury Room in 2006. It's probably the rarest. Pitched at £6,000 to £8,000 at Woolley and Wallace's October the 29th sale, it sold for £15,000. And overall, that's round about 30,000 Australian dollars all up. Now that's a price you probably won't forget in a hurry, and it's also a little reminder of how to pronounce that Irish provincial town, Youghal, as in boat. And of course the town mark itself is the emblem of a Youghal. And our third and final item of silver brings us back to Australia. It's also from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 18th of January, and it's written by Roland Arkell. Evan Jones of Sydney. A pair of 19th century electroplated cups offered by Andrew Smith & Sons, 21% buyer's premium, at Alsford on December the 11th, is stamped for the noted Sydney silversmith Evan Jones, 1846 to 1917. Apprenticed from the age of 12, his business with a workshop in Erskine Street was first listed in the Sydney Directory for 1873. The firm produced gold and silver racing cups, rowing and sculling trophies, and decorative tableware, as well as epergnes with motifs drawn from the local flora and fauna. At the Sydney International Exhibition of 1879, Australia's first, Jones showed emu eggs mounted in 101 different ways. This relatively modest pair of 6.5-inch, that's 17-centimetre, cups with stems cast with Aborigine heads underlined the demand for Australian silverware when it took a surprise £1,900 against an estimate of £80 to £120. You would have noticed that they are electroplated, that is, a thin layer of silver over a base metal, and they are not solid silver, in which case they would have fetched a considerably larger sum of money. And let's stay with the Antipodes, and we turn to the Antique Trade Gazette of the 11th of January, and we move from silver to artefacts. Australasian artefacts. Australasia provided the talking point and two main buyers at the Tennants, 20% buyer's premium, specialist sale in the Yorkshire Dales on December the 13th. An Aboriginal parrying shield with an integral handle was worked with carved bands of concentric diamonds. It was catalogued as a 20th century and estimated at £400 to £600. But traces of white pigment to the recesses suggested to bidders the 2-foot-10-inch, that's 86-centimetre, long shield had at least some age, and it sold at £4,500. For the second time in 3 months, the sale room offered one of the Platina Resolution medals made in 1772 for Captain James Cook to give to Indigenous people encountered during his second voyage of discovery to the South Seas and Australasia. On one side is a bust of the king and the words George IV, King of Great Britain, France, Ireland, etc. The other depicts Cook's two vessels, Resolution and Adventure. The earlier example which triggered this latest consignment to the Leyburn Rooms took £3,200. This one, drilled to take a ribbon, went down under at £1,700. And just before you ring in and complain, which you'd be entitled to do so, I think there was a typographical error there. It should have read George III, not George IV, being 1772, which puts it certainly in George III's reign. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network. How do you stop desirable items leaving a country? If deemed significant to the nation and the item is purchased by a foreigner and destined to disappear from local access and appreciation, what does the nation do? Well, here are two stories, both involving paintings, which came under review by British and French authorities respectively. From the Antiques Trade Gazette of the 11th of January 2020, Gainsborough Painting Export Bar. The owner of a Thomas Gainsborough, 1727 to 1788, painting has been temporarily prevented from exporting the picture by the Department for Digital Culture, Media and Sport. Going to Market Early Morning was painted in 1773. It was bought at a Sotheby's auction in July 2019. The export bar follows the advice of the Reviewing Committee on the Export of Works of Art and Objects of Cultural Interest. The committee agreed that the painting was a brilliant example of Gainsborough's finest work, and that the unbroken provenance was extremely rare. The painting's significance for the study of Gainsborough's relationships with his patrons and landscape art was another factor. The decision on the export license application for the painting will be deferred until March the 22nd. This may be extended until September the 22nd, 2020, if a serious intention to raise is made at the recommended price of £7.96 million, plus £234,200 in VAT. Let's now have a look at the French example. And this also comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 11th of January. Search for French Cimabue buyer. The French government has blocked the export of The Mocking of Christ, a medieval panel by Cenni di Pepo, known as Cimabue, that sold in October for €19.5 million plus premium at auction house Acteon. Now classified as a national treasure, the state has 30 months to make an offer to acquire the work from its current owners. Under French law, the painting cannot leave the country during this period, and the authorities have the right to renew the export restriction if the owner refuses to accept the state's purchase offer. At the sale in Senlis, around 50 miles from Paris, on October the 27th, the Cimabue panel was estimated at €4 to 6 million, but drew dramatic competition well above this level, setting a record for a medieval panel. It became the eighth most expensive old master ever sold. And staying with paintings, but looking at a very different angle, what sort of support was there for physical disabilities in the early 19th century? Take away any of today's technological advances, remove any notion of a national health system or a national disability insurance scheme, and uninvent the notion of inclusiveness or the excellent work this radio station 2RPH does. And what are you left with? This is an astonishing story for many reasons. And we read from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 21st of December, 2019. Biffin's powerful story recognised with £110,000 self-portrait. artist Sarah Biffin, 1784 to 1850, is believed to have had the condition phocomelia and was born without hands, arms or feet, writes Laura Chesters. Growing up in Somerset, she taught herself to write, paint, sew and use scissors, holding the pen, brush or needle between her teeth. Around the age of 13, a travelling showman persuaded her parents to allow her to tour the country. He exhibited her as a freak and paid her a salary of £5 a year to paint miniatures in front of an audience at fairs. It was not until 16 years later that Biffin was released from her contract and the support of Earl of Morton received lessons from the Royal Academician William Craig, who died in 1827. Demand for her portraits and miniatures grew, and she was commissioned by high society and royalty and exhibited her work at the Royal Academy. At the peak of Biffin's popularity, her London studio became so well known she's mentioned in three Charles Dickens novels. Her remarkable story was retold at Sotheby's on the December the 5th with the sale of a Biffin self-portrait as part of the third tranche of the Paul Struer collection of portrait miniatures. Estimated at £1,200 to £1,800, it sold for a hammer price of £110,000 to a collector. Lawrence Hendrer, director of Philip Maldon Company, was among the underbidders. The story of Biffin's life and the fact she was so talented, considering her disability, is what attracts the bidders. People have a profound respect for those who are able to overcome adversity, and I can think of few other artists who achieved this to a greater extent than Biffin. Only a handful of works by Biffin have come up at auction. The previous high for the artist appears to be the £1,600 bid at Bonham's Knightsbridge in 2009 for a lady seated in a red upholstered chair. But Hendrer believes that may now change. I have no doubt at all that this sale will cause a major price adjustment. Her miniatures will be hotly fought over in the sale rooms. The 5.4-inch by which is 12.5 by 10.5 centimetres, circa 1821, watercolour on ivory, is a variant of a self-portrait which was engraved by R.W. Seaver and published in London in June 1821. Biffin's work, occasionally spelt B-I-F-F-E-N, is sometimes signed Mrs. E.M. Wright, her name from a short-lived marriage in 1824. After demand for her portrait miniatures fell, she financed her final years with help from supporters and a civil list pension awarded by Queen Victoria. Now that's a fairly powerful story. But now for a change of topic, but still one that highlights a changing world of attitudes, acceptability and appreciation. Religion, sex and politics. What we were once told to avoid discussing in polite company. These are, of course, inextricably linked with antiques and the arts, either the objects themselves or their surrounding circumstances and connections. Being showcases of such objects, museums often come under the spotlight. Are there things they should not or could not have displayed in the past? Or indeed things that ought to be hidden from view today? Here's a piece to help you to mould your view. It's also rather well written and amusing. And this comes from the Australian newspaper's art section on Monday the 29th of January. It originally appeared in the Times newspaper and was written by Ben McIntyre. British Museum coyly bears secrets, spreads its naughty bits for all to see. World's greatest collection of sex objects should be displayed altogether. The British Museum finds itself in an uncomfortable position, mounting an exhibition about Tantra, the ancient Indian philosophy, while arguing that it's not all about sex. Pop star Sting brought the concept of tantric sex to a new audience when he claimed in the early 1990s the philosophy had enabled him to copulate continuously for 4 or 5 hours. But he turned a sophisticated, complex and esoteric set of rites and beliefs about enlightenment and divinity into a source of sniggers. It's not about pleasure for its own sake, the exhibition organisers insist, rather frantically. But Tantra is at least partly about sex, which is why visitors will flock to the exhibition in their thousands. Because sex is fascinating, particularly ancient, illicit and foreign sorts of sex, and the British Museum knows it. Across the centuries, it secretly assembled one of the finest collections of sex objects in the world, thanks to a uniquely British combination of prudery and prurience. Of all the reasons to keep the museum's great collection intact, its unparalleled assortment of sex artefacts is up there with the Elgin marbles. So far from shying away from the subject, the museum should put all its long-hidden sex collection on permanent display, telling the extraordinary story of sex through the ages and revealing how far attitudes to that ticklish subject have evolved. The British Museum reflected the Victorian approach to sex in all its squirming ambivalence. In 1865, after the passage of the world's first Obscene Publications Act, the museum locked away its already vast collection of rude things, described by curators as abominable monuments to human licentiousness. Thus was formed the Secret Museum, or Secretum, a repository of more than 1,200 objects that the arbiters of morality wished to shield from the eyes of women, children, and the working classes. In cupboard 55 went images and artefacts relating to copulation of every imaginable variety, ancient contraceptives, Far Eastern and Indian erotica, classical vases depicting homosexuality, erotic Japanese shunga prints involving octopuses, and a chastity belt of the sort jealous knights Templar clamped onto their wives when they went off crusading. Many of the objects involved gods getting laid in unacceptable ways, an image of Pan getting all goaty with a goat, a 3,000-year-old papyrus depicting auto-fertility in which the deity Jeb performs fellatio on himself, do not try this at home, an innocent-seeming snuff box that opened to reveal an energetic couple of deities in flagrante delicto on a long-suffering donkey. Cupboard 55 contained the 16th century equivalent of the Joy of Sex, engravings of sexual positions, there were 16 in Renaissance Italy, under the Latin title of De Omnibus Veneris Schematibus, as well as the oldest sex image ever discovered, an 11,000-year-old carved calcite pebble from the Judean desert depicting entwined lovers, an object that looks like a pair of testicles from one angle and a phallus from the other. Much of the collection was assembled by George Witt, a former mayor of Bedford, who donated 434 phallic objects from around the world that he collected, he claimed not entirely convincingly, on the theory that all ancient religions were based on penis worship. Witt probably feared prosecution under the new Obscenity Act. My favourite object from the spectrum, I beg your pardon, the secretum, is the membership card of the Beggar's Benison, an 18th century Scottish dining society of bishops, magistrates and aristocrats who met at Driel Castle to plot the Jacobite rebellion and talk about sex. The president wore a large wig made from the pubic hair of one of Charles II's mistresses. At the end of the evening, members measured their members on a pewter plate engraved for the purpose. This is what Scottish independence is all about. For a century, only gentlemen scholars of mature years and sound morals were allowed to peer inside cupboard 55. Exhibition to a wider audience, it was feared, would outrage public decency, undermine virtue, and perhaps bring down the empire. Those Victorian curators were not motivated solely by prudery. The objects were considered indecent, but they were also important in interesting and, in many instances, beautiful, and so they were preserved in the greatest repository of history on earth. Virtually every country in the world has sex museums, from Iceland's Phallological Museum to the fairly alarming Sex Machines Museum in Prague. But there is nothing to compare in imaginative variety and historical importance to the British Museum's naughty cupboard. In the 1960s changed all that. The objects in cupboard 55, no longer considered a threat to taste and decorum, were dispersed to other parts of the museum. In 1999, the museum controversially acquired for £1.8 million the Warren Cup, a Roman silver chalice decorated in relief with two images of male same-sex acts. The acquisition proved, one vicar claimed, that the museum was staffed by sodomites. But the Warren Cup is now on permanent display, a stunning work of art inspiring not shock, but awe. Today, the secretum is no longer secret, and is said to house only a collection of wax penises. Italian votive offerings collected by Sir William Hamilton, famously cuckolded by Admiral Horatio Nelson, and some 18th century condoms made from animals' intestines tied at the top with pink ribbons. Cupboard 55 is almost bare. Today, the great collection should be reassembled and displayed in its entirety. Everything you ever wanted to see about sex, but were too British to ask. Sting can open it, if he's not too tired. And perhaps there'll be a follow-up article in The Times, which the Australian newspaper will reprint in its art section. But we could also ask, are Australian museums hiding anything? And how would you find out anyway? And finally, something from newsletter.artnet.com, written by Sarah Casconi, appeared on the 24th of January 2020. This ceramic artist survived the Australian wildfires by crawling inside his kiln. Artist Steve Harrison survived an Australian wildfire that overtook his home by climbing inside his homemade pottery kiln. As the flames hurtled towards artist Steve Harrison's home in rural Australia last month, he made every effort to defend his property, powering up pumps and sprinklers in preparation for the approaching inferno. But when it came time to evacuate, the road had caught fire, and the 67-year-old potter's only option was to climb inside his kiln and wait for the blaze to pass. Miraculously, he survived. "The fire was too big, too hot, too fast," Harrison wrote in his blog. "I couldn't get out." Fortunately, Harrison had built a makeshift kiln from fireproof ceramic fibre the day before. Faced with no other choice, he crawled inside with a bag of laptops and hard drives, a fire extinguisher, a fire blanket and a bottle of water. The kiln, which kept heat out as well as in, offered life-saving protection. "I was in there for half an hour while the firestorm went over. It was huge, just glowing orange-red everywhere. Just scary. I was terrified," Harrison told Australian news outlet ABC. When the ceramicist emerged, his home was still standing, but the kiln shed, the kiln factory, and the woodshed, as well as the pottery gallery storing the artist's work, had burned to the ground. "This was catastrophic," an emotional Harrison told ABC. "You can see when you look around, there's nothing left." And that very interesting article from Sarah Casconi, appearing in newsletter at artnet.com on January the 24th, has a happy ending and continues. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811. Or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.